in the mix.
Good evening, folks. This is KPFT Houston. The show is Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth. I am Dean Becker. Our producer tonight is Steve Nolan. A little bit later, our guest will be the Reverend Alan Bean of Tulia, Texas. You may or may not have heard of Alan Bean, but by now most everyone has heard of Tulia. The New York Times, the Houston Chronicle, Newsweek, and Time Magazine have all written about the terrible injustice there, where on one hot summer night, 43 people were arrested, 40 of them black men and women, and they were all arrested based on the word of one man, the lone ranger of the drug war, one Tom Coleman. We'll also hear from Noam Chomsky's recent words about the drug war, which are right on the money in this regard. Please join us for what is sure to be a very stimulating look at the racism that still exists. That is, in fact, the very fabric of the drug war in the Americas. We'll also have the second edition of the War of Terror Playhouse. We were going to visit with folks at the Drug Sense chat room live and online, but apparently the web servers are down or something. We can't seem to figure out what it is. Now, I want to say something. When I talk to people about this show, I usually call it my show, as if I did the whole thing by myself. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It's people like you, my listeners, that gave this show, Cultural Baggage, the best rating of any program that airs on KPFT for the recent fund drive. Your pledges to this show meant that we exceeded our fundraising goal by more than 600%. And I want to thank you for your pledges. It means a lot to me, but more importantly, it means a lot to the longevity of this show, and it means we are accepted in the community. And I do want to thank you. But here in the studio and out on the streets and at events here in Houston and elsewhere, I do not work alone either. Steve Nolan has been instrumental in building this show, in designing how it works, doing news reports, and in knowing how to best catch your ear. His wife, Cheryl, has been the backbone of coordinating guest link-ups, in taking your calls and your questions, and in coordinating events for DPFT, Houston Normal, and for Americans for Safe Access. Tamara Halfman has been a constant, both here at the rallies and helping with guests, and again, taking your calls and your pledges, and she's at every event at the courthouse and in the prisons, and now. She's also become our latest reporter. Folks, you've not lived till you spent a day at the DEA headquarters or at the federal courthouse with cops and cameras all around and a sign in your hand that says prohibition is evil. This coming Monday at 4:30 p.m. at the county criminal courthouse, we will be doing an event just like this. We'll be there handing out literature to people, to judges and lawyers and cops as they leave the building. And we hope you'll be there with us. I'll give you the address a little bit later. Our first news report today is from last Friday night, right here in Houston. And our own cannabis flower, Tamara Halfern, got the chance to speak to Noam Chomsky, and here is what she had to say.
I've been an activist for a number of years in the war against the users of some drugs. And with the passage of the Patriot Act and with all this stuff coming up with against the war on terrorism, recently they've been trying to paint the war on drugs as people who use drugs are terrorists. And I'd kind of like you to comment on this a little bit.
Well, substances, drugs is a funny word, but there are harmful substances. One of them, in fact, is a white powder. There's one white powder, which is by far the most lethal known. That's called sugar. It's not a joke, incidentally. And in fact, if you look at the history of imperialism, a lot of it has to do with it. You know, a lot of the imperial conquests in the Caribbean set up a kind of a network. And the Caribbean back in the 17th and 18th century was a soft drug producer. Sugar, rum, tobacco, you know, chocolate. And in order to do it, they had to enslave Africans. And it was done largely to pacify working people in England who were being driven into, you know, awful circumstances by the early Industrial Revolution. That's why so many wars took place around the Caribbean. And sugar was one main part of it, and other soft drugs. If you take other substances, you know, it's not the substances themselves, it's how they're processed, but let's overlook that. Like tobacco, you know, on the plant doesn't harm anybody. But tobacco is, with that qualification, is by far the most lethal substance known, you know. I mean, apart from things like sugar and stuff like that. Nobody suggests that people who smoke should be put in jail. And nobody says that, say, China has a right to bomb Kentucky and North Carolina, you know, because we're not only exporting those lethal drugs to substances to them, which are killing millions of people, but we're even forcing them to run advertising for them. Like the Colombian cartel isn't permitted to put, you know, ads on TV saying how great it would be to, you know, shoot this stuff.
Tammy got the scoop, the real truth. She got one of the most respected thinkers of our day to open up for more than 7 minutes about the drug war. We will have more from Mr. Chomsky a little bit later. What Tammy did, though, should give us all cause to pause and think a moment. You are the media. Tammy proves that. And until we all deny the responsibility for the maintenance of truth to the corporate media, we will be subject to slanted, bigoted, corporate-serving news that does not seek to find justice, or rather seeks to find the ultimate profits for those who would be our corporate masters. Now, before I introduce our next guest, I want us to listen to what a couple of other folks had to say about the great injustice of Tulia. This was recorded about 2 years ago on the steps of the state capitol in Austin as part of the Texas Journey for Justice. The first speaker is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas, Dr. Al Robinson.
I told you earlier that the war on drugs was causing more harm to our society than the drugs themselves could ever cause. But the destructive impact of this insane policy has perhaps never been better illustrated than by what happened last year in Tulia, Texas. We asked Charles Kecker to come and tell us about it. He's a Baptist minister who was born and raised in Tulia, and he brought with him a group of his fellow citizens. Charles, thanks for coming. The war on drugs is a war on people. A war on poor people, and especially on black people. All over the country, blacks are arrested, convicted, and imprisoned for drug crimes in numbers far disproportionate to their population and far disproportionate to their use of and dealing in drugs. This is true all over the country, but it's outrageously true in Tulia. Tulia is a little town of about 5,000 out in the panhandle, about 480 miles northwest of here. And in this little town, an undercover drug operation was undertaken in Tulia starting in early 1998 and continuing for some 18 months. Then in the early morning hours of July 23rd, 1999, police began their arrests. When the arrests were completed, no drugs were found at the arrests, no money was found, no guns were found. Of those arrested, at least 39 of them were black. This in a town with a black population of only 246, according to the 1990 census. 16% of the black population are and that undercover agent, his reputation in Cochran County, Texas, where he served as sheriff, prior as deputy sheriff, prior to his employment in Tulia, was that he was not believable. His former boss, the sheriff of Kentucky, John Bushinger, and about that home, he wrote the Rock Commission on Law Enforcement Standards that this undercover agent should not be in law enforcement. Yet the word of this man, the word of this man who is not believable, the word of a man who did not wear a wire, the word of a man which was uncorroborated by any independent evidence, has created 23 prisoners of war and about 35 POW orphans.
Well, it doesn't leave us a lot to be proud of, the treatment that the law enforcement has thrown on these people of Tulia. But I am proud to introduce my next guest, a man of honor, a man who seeks dignity for those around him, a man who seeks the truth. And I'm proud to welcome the Reverend Alan Bean. Are you there, Alan? Hello. Okay. Are you there, Alan?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Now, welcome to Cultural Baggage.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, sir. For those who may not have heard of what happened in Tulia, could you give us a quick summary of what occurred there?
Okay. Well, it's hard to know where to start or when to stop. I'm writing a book about Tulia, and of course, when you do that, you delve in a little further than a lot of people want to go. But to make a long story and a very complicated story short and simple, Tulia decided in 1998 that they were going to have bring in an undercover agent. They got a grant from the Panhandle Task Force in Amarillo, and they paid this guy about $20,000 a year to come in and just kind of insinuate his way into the local culture. But Tom Coleman, the man's name, he went by T.J. Dawson, was his street name, was radically unsupervised. Nobody had a clue what he was doing, he didn't wear a wire, as Reverend Tucker was saying in the clip that you had there. He didn't have any video surveillance. Nobody monitored his comings and goings. And so when he, 18 months later, resurfaced with all these cases that he had made over that period of time, it was always a swearing match when it came to jury trials between Mr. Coleman and the accused. In a situation like that, it was obviously very difficult to win a case, because when you've got to choose between who you're going to believe, a law officer who John Cornyn had named the Texas Lawman of the Year, and that Sheriff Larry Stewart called a man of integrity and professionalism, or a guy who is an accused drug dealer, who are you going to believe? Well, it wasn't a very difficult choice for the juries. And again, they not only convicted these people, but handed out draconian sentences of up to 90, 99 years. One person, when the sentences were all added together, had over 300 years.
My gosh.
We were first made aware of just how horrendous the situation was after Joe Moore was given 90 years. And that really sent shockwaves through the black community, because everybody knew that although Booty, as they called him, Booty Woody, had been a bootlegger for years and a gambler, and had run a kind of a juke joint out in the black end of town for many decades. They knew also that after having done a short stretch in prison, that he was deathly afraid of going back, and that he would regularly lecture young men about the dangers of drugs. He didn't want anybody associated with using or dealing drugs in his home, and he sort of lived in a panic fear of being sent back to prison on drug charges, and kind of organized his life around not going back to prison. So when this guy was arrested and convicted and sentenced to 90 years for doing the very thing that everybody knew he wasn't doing, it scared people in the black community in an almost unspeakable way. It would be very difficult to exaggerate or to overstate the degree of panic. And that is kind of the state everybody was in when we all got together the first time. And it sort of went from there. And there was a period of about 4 to 6 months, depending on how you measure it, where we couldn't get anybody to listen to us. The media had just sort of forgotten about the issue. One local paper in town, which is now defunct, followed the court cases, but the Tulia Herald, which was the traditional paper in town, the one that's still in existence, completely ignored it. And the outside world seemed to be blissfully aware that anything horrendous like this had happened, and it wasn't until Nate Blakeslee of the Texas Observer came to town at the invitation of Lilia Barra, who was a Boston University of Boston law student who was working as a VISTA volunteer in a nearby community. She contacted Nate and asked if he could come down, and at that time he was working as a staff writer for the Texas Observer, and he came and did an in-depth study. He drove to Cochran County and talked to some of the people that some of the attorneys had already talked to, found out the truth about Coleman, wrote this wonderful article called The Color of Justice, which has won many awards, was picked up by the Austin Chronicle, and came to the attention of Will Harrell and Al Robison of the Drug Policy
Forum?
Yeah, of Texas. And that is what gave birth to the rally that we had on the steps of the legislature in Austin there, that you heard at the beginning of this segment.
Yes, sir. I wanted to ask you a quick question. Was it the Tulia Herald that had the headline the next day, something along the lines of taking out the garbage? Is that correct?
No, that was the Sentinel, oddly enough. I've had occasion to talk to Mike Garrett, who was the person who wrote that absolutely horrendous editorial. And he told me that he really did believe in the drug war, and he really did believe that Tulia had a drug problem. And he got a call from Sheriff Larry Stewart and also from the Chief of Police, Jimmy McCaslin. They said, be at the courthouse at 7 o'clock the next morning and bring your camera. And they also, I assume, called Channel 7, the ABC affiliate in Amarillo. And so in the nightly news that evening, the 23rd of July, 1999, you saw these pictures of one African-American person, scantily clad, disheveled, hair unbrushed, being dragged in their nightclothes into the jailhouse. And these were very degrading images that really, I think, were intended to create the impression that these people really are scumbags. And Mike really went along with that. I think at that point his newspaper was kind of on the rocks, and he wanted to sensationalize this as much as possible just as a way of gaining readership. But the more things dragged on, and when some of us, like Gary Gardner, Charles Kiker, myself, started writing letters to the editor asking questions about this Tom Coleman guy and why the defense attorneys were not allowed to ask him questions about his professional history, Mike started to think about the question a lot more seriously. And he's now in writing for a paper in Pueblo, Colorado. He told me that he's pretty convinced that Mr. Coleman really is a rotten egg and that the sting was illegitimate. But at the time, he wasn't aware of that. To be honest with you, that editorial where he called he didn't call them alleged drug dealers, he called them known drug dealers, called them scumbags, and said now it's, you know, they've been a cancer on our society, and now it's time to given him a good dose of chemotherapy behind bars. I went to our Sunday school class down the street at the Baptist church, and it was one of the movers and shakers class. Everybody who was anybody in the town, the church, was in this class. And one fellow who turned out to have been a jury foreman on one of the trials was sitting across the table from me. We met around these tables, sort of in a big square. And I said, you know, something's really bothering me. He said, we just moved to town a year ago, and I don't know very much about these people who were picked up in this drug sting, but the paper called them scumbags. And I said, these people have not had the benefit of a trial, and I just thought that was a terrible epithet to throw out, especially when they haven't had their day in court. This guy just exploded. His face got red, and he said, "That's exactly what they are. They're scumbags, and they're all guilty, and they're going, you know, they're going down." Basically, is what he was saying. And another gentleman who's on the school board put me aside after the class. I think he sort of saw the shock registering in my face, and he said, "It's these black athletes." He said, "They're." We treat them like gods, you know, and they're messing around with our daughters, and they're selling their drugs, and something's got to be done. Something had to be done. And that really tipped me off that this was not your ordinary drug bust. And so several months later, in December, when Joe Moore went down for 90 years, we realized it was very much of a faith issue for us, that we didn't have a choice. We had to fight this thing.
Well, Alan, I, as I mentioned earlier, Tamara Halpern recorded some Q&A with Noam Chomsky.
Yes.
And he has some very astute comments. I have another little segment here I'd like to play, and then perhaps we can respond to his statements.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Steve.
These are real problems. Tobacco is a problem, right?
Yep.
And in fact, we know how to deal with it. And in fact, there's successes in dealing with it. I mean, I haven't seen a student in my office smoking a cigarette in probably 15 years, unless European. And that was not because of criminalization. It was because of education. I mean, throughout the 1980s, particularly, this had a lot to do with the war on drugs. Through the 1980s, there was a decline among relatively educated people, like, say, people who are likely to go to college. There was a decline in the use of all kinds of harmful substances, you know, hard drugs, soft drugs, tobacco, alcohol, red meat, you know, all kinds of things declined. And that was part of, you know, people taking up a healthier lifestyle. And yeah, that's what they do. In fact, it's a lot to do with the war on drugs. I mentioned in my talk, Moynihan is not my favorite person in the world, but he is the one senator who pays some attention to social statistics. And when the latest phase of the war on drugs was called in the late 80s, he pointed out that if we pass this legislation, we're declaring a crime wave among minorities. Okay, and the reason was, if you look at the trend lines among it's a real close race class correlation in the United States, not perfect, but close. Among sort of roughly more educated sectors, use of things like drugs was declining. When it had peaked, like in 1979, you didn't throw a lot of people into jail because those were children of wealthy people executives going home to their homes, and you don't throw those people in jail. But as it declined through the 80s and remained sort of steady among poorer sections of the population, at that point, if you declare a drug war, you're criminalizing the poor. And that's what happened. It's not accidental that the number of people and, you know, the number of black males in jail is shot way up for victimless crimes, like the kid is caught with a joint in his pocket and, you know, downtown or something. Yeah, that was planned. And furthermore, criminologists are well aware of it. Look at the criminology literature, mainstream, you know, they point this out. In fact, a lot of these criminalization campaigns way back really have to do with what's called controlling the dangerous classes. You know? taking. The same was true of prohibition and other things.
Alan, I were you able to hear that?
Yes, I was.
Does he not nail it right on the head there? I think. I read a comment earlier this week. The DPA had put out a comment about why America's prisoners are getting blacker and browner, and it's just outrageous the information gave us that it's apartheid like criminal justice system, which is I think very much what we have.
I've been driven to the conclusion, it's not a very happy conclusion, that if you're white and well connected, you really do live in a constitutional republic or a democracy. But if you're a person of color and you're not well connected, you really pretty much live in a police state. And so when people say America is a police state, you know, for most people that isn't true. But for, I'd say, the underclass, particularly that segment of the underclass that is African-American and Hispanic in particular, that is a very accurate statement. Now, I know there are many African-American people who are upwardly mobile, well-educated, who are sort of given a pass to some extent, but they don't live in Tulia, Texas, and they don't live in the poor side of most American cities. When you're talking about ghettos, and when you're talking about the ethnic sections, the Hispanic section, the barrio, or the what used to be called nigger town, if you'll excuse the expression, in most American towns, you're not talking about those people. And increasingly, people who live in places like that do experience their society as a police state. They are harassed. They are hassled. They are scrutinized to an alarming extent. And if they are unfortunate enough to be arrested, especially if the charge is drugs, it doesn't really matter whether there's any evidence or not. They are going down.
Because they're scumbags, as the gentleman said.
Right. A juror looks at a person like that, especially if they don't know how to hold themselves, they don't know how to sit, they don't know how to dress, they don't look as if they'd know what to do if they were at a dinner party and they had more than one fork. And they says to themselves, you know, I don't know who this guy is, but he looks kind of dangerous to me. And I think television dramas and cop shows really perpetuate these stereotypes.
What do we have, 20 years of Miami Vice now?
That's right. If I say this guy is not guilty and he turns out to really be a drug dealer, then he's peddling his poison to my kids on the street. If I say they really look at a law of averages. You know, what's the downside of putting this guy in prison if he's innocent? Well, you know, I'll never know. And he probably is guilty of something just looking at him. And if he isn't dealing drugs now, he probably will get into it sooner or later. So might as well put him in prison. And that's the kind of mental calculus that goes on. And I don't think it's fully conscious. But people just do not presume the innocence. They seem to be incapable of presuming the innocence until guilt is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Whereas, if the person was wearing a three-piece suit was well coiffed and had lots of community support out there in the gallery, I think the presumption of innocence would be working overtime, and you'd really have to have a strong case. And I think the Noelle Bush situation in Florida is just one illustration of that.
Yes,
she was not treated the way the people in Tulia were. Let me tell you.
No,
they were not given 10 days.
No, I don't know what to say about that, except, you know, it's I hope the benefit that she's gained from this situation is dispersed to all the other people needing drug treatment around the country.
Right. I don't think the point is that I don't think she should have done any time because she obviously has an addiction problem, and that is something that is not easily overcome, and certainly sticking somebody with that kind of a problem in prison is not going to help anybody. One of the things that we've been able to watch up close in Tulia is that when you remove somebody, even if that person does have a serious addiction, something like crack cocaine, if you take that person out of the society and stick them away, you have removed the only male that a lot of these kids have. And you take away a mother, you take away a father. The kids have to be raised by a family member who is completely overburdened emotionally and financially.
Sure.
And it really has a detrimental impact on these kids. You can just see them closing in on themselves. You can see them losing their trust for authority and their respect for authority. You can see them losing hope. Starting to develop all kinds of self-hatred and hatred for others, and just sort of lashing out and acting out, and they're very, very difficult to work with. Not every kid. I mean, some kids just manage to flourish in the most horrendous situations, but the average kid just never recovers from something like that.
Well,
so you're not just punishing a person who's supposedly the offender. You're punishing the whole family.
Yes, you're punishing generations all at once.
Yes.
Yes, sir. Just another little segment I wanted to glean from this report that the DPA had put out. They're saying for young black men born in 1966, they are more likely to have gone to prison than to have graduated from a four-year college. Of the men and women serving more than 1 year in state prisons for drug-related offenses in 2001, over three-quarters were people of color. One other thing, with 2 million Americans now doing time behind bars, our country now imprisons roughly 500,000 men and women on drug-related charges at an average annual cost of $9.4 billion.
Right.
I know that many of the prestigious newspapers and magazines have begun looking at this, as you had mentioned earlier.
Sure.
Was it Bob Herbert of the New York Times who did an ongoing series?
That's right, yes.
Tell us what he had to say. What did the folks in New York think of this situation?
Okay. Well, the first article, I have the New York Times as my home page, and so I just got up one morning. We were going to head out to Colorado for a quick vacation, and I just flipped on the computer, and there was, it just caught my eye, Kafka in Tulia. That was such an unlikely name for a piece. So I opened it up, and he had a pretty good summary of the situation, and I didn't realize that this was just an opening salvo in a six-part series that he was going to write on Tulia. And he did an excellent job of summarizing all the really significant issues that were involved in the Tulia cases, including the fact that the investigation, which the Department of Justice had initiated with great fanfare well over a year, or 22 months actually, previous to that, had just fizzled out and had been swept under the rug. As soon as John Ashcroft became Attorney General, I was pretty sure that's exactly what was going to happen to that investigation. And so I thought it was a wonderful thing that Bob Herbert started stirring some of these things up. And he's a hard man to ignore, being the most prestigious African-American columnist in the United States and writing for the flagship newspaper in the country.
The Gray Lady?
Yeah, you can't ignore something like that. And so that stirred up a lot of interest. One of the things we've noticed, of course, is that you get these little firestorms of media attention, and then they lose interest and wander off and get involved in other things. And that has happened again. But
well, how about with the politicians of late who didn't even create a firestorm, showed up and basically ignored the whole situation there in Tulia? Am I correct?
That's right. we had Tony Sanchez came to town, and you know, I called around, and we went through our Friends of Justice phone list, and we got about 15 people down there, you know, just on the spur of the moment. I just sort of found out word of mouth that this was going to be happening, and I talked to Mr. Sanchez briefly, you know, and what have you, but he was interviewed by some of the television people that were there, and he said, well, it isn't proper to politicize this issue. I hope that justice is done, and several other noncommittal comments. But the very fact that he decided to make a whistle stop in Tulia, Texas, I think speaks for itself. He was trying to politicize the situation. Ron Kirk criticized his opponent for the senatorial position that Phil Graham vacated for not John Cornyn being the existing attorney general, as most of the listeners will know, for being for not initiating his study or his investigation into Tullia sooner. But Mr. Kirk was in a very difficult position because no politician gains votes by appearing soft on drugs and soft on crime. And that has been the problem with politicians, that they cannot address the issues in Tullia without giving the impression that they are anti-law enforcement, that they're pro-drugs. You know, people tend to have very simplistic categories in these areas, and they don't want to give the wrong signals. So the easiest thing and the most expedient thing for a politician to do is simply to ignore that the whole subject. You find the same phenomenon within the clergy, and so you don't get very much help from the churches, including, unfortunately, the black churches. And I don't want to fire a broadside against black clergy, but I know that the people in Tullia, in the African-American community, have not really felt the support of the local churches, and they didn't expect it from the white churches, but this is an issue right across the country that, you know, where are the preachers? There are some wonderful African-American pastors who have
luckily
spoken out. But
here in Houston, we do have a couple of local black ministers that are working with Judge McSpadden, as you're probably well aware.
Yes, I've noticed.
Tom Marshall would indicate.
Yeah.
Alan, let me interrupt here just a second. I want to play another piece from Chomsky. Give us a little bit more meat to chew on here, I think. Maybe point out some outrage, if we could.
Sure.
By the way, callers out there, if you would like to call in, we're going to have a few minutes. I'd love to hear from you. You could ask Alan a question or two. Our number here, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738.
And I mean, now, why was marijuana criminalized? Well, a large part of the reason was it was smoked by Mexicans and by blacks in Harlem. And, you know, when the prohibition was over and the Bureau of Narcotics had nothing to do, they hit on marijuana, you know, not for any medical reason. And a lot of the history of prohibition is like this. In fact, if you look at the just mainstream criminology literature, it's called controlling the dangerous classes. And, yeah, I think that's what the word is about. It's nothing to do with helping people who have drug problems. You want to do that? The way to do it is prevention through educational programs and treatment. And that works. Actually, one of the good things that Nixon did was put money into that, and it worked. The new programs don't do that because they're not trying to deal with the problem. They're trying to do something else. I mean, like, you know, chemical warfare in Colombia is outrageous. I mean, it would be like China bombing North Carolina. And what it's doing is driving peasants off the land, which will then be taken over by mining companies. It will strip mine and agribusiness for monoculture, agri-export, and so on. I mean, the whole idea is outrageous in the first place, but the way it's implemented is just destroying people's lives.
Thank you.
And the same is true domestically.
Okay, that was the last piece we have from Noam Chomsky. Alan, we do have Denise from Houston is on line one. Let's see if we can get her online now. Denise, are you there? Hello, Denise. Let's show she's online. She ain't talking. Are you there? Denise? Okay. All right. Well, we're just going to go on here. Again, folks, if you want to call, 713-526-5738. Alan, is there additional comments that they're telling me? Denise, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Denise. Do you have a question for Alan Me?
I have a comment. I've been listening to the show for about the last half an hour, or about 20 minutes, actually. And I was especially concerned about the view of how there are so many people of color or minorities that have been incarcerated.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm one of those people. And it just was fortunate that I had the faith and resources in Houston to help me to come back to the level of contributing to society. And it is very difficult when you look at the world the way that it is now. The money that's spent on prisons is like, why can't that money be put in another aspect?
Education.
No, much more than that. And it's almost as if you have to dig into yourself to find what it is about you that can keep you afloat in spite of everything. The other thing was that I heard the gentleman mention something about churches.
Yes.
There are many churches in Houston that are doing things that you will not even realize. And I think that you have to look at the church not only as what it's doing related to issues related to substance abuse or community outreach related to HIV and AIDS, because there are foundations that the churches provide to us, many people, in a daily aspect of life, on a day-by-day basis. So in many ways, I think it's unfair to say, it's hard to say what churches are not doing until you really know what they are.
Do you want to comment on that, Alan?
Yeah, of course, it's very difficult to generalize. I know many churches have wonderful programs of one kind or another. What we really don't have are prophetic voices speaking out against public, addressing public policy issues and saying why, especially African-American preachers saying, why are so many of our people going to prison? And coming up with some probing answers to that question. And I know there are many African-American pastors who are doing precisely that. I just think we need to have vastly more. And I sometimes think that especially for pastors of middle-class congregations, a lot of these issues simply are not addressed. And that is a problem, I think, especially in the Texas panhandle here, where the percentage of the population that is minority, especially African-American, tends to be rather small in a lot of these communities. And there isn't much organized opposition to the status quo. I think there is a great reluctance to address the issue just because it makes people uncomfortable.
I think that there needs to be some focus on the issues that are some of the things that can prevent people from being there.
Mm-hmm.
Whose responsibility is that?
I don't quite follow you, Denisa. What do you mean?
What I'm saying is that if you're saying that there are not enough, if you're saying that there are not ministers or people in churches who are acknowledging the problem that is existing right now publicly.
Yes.
Then why isn't the focus on, instead of the fact that there are so many people of color or minorities in prisons and so forth and so on, why isn't it being addressed as to the reason why they're there,
okay,
why they're going there, and the things we can do to help it, redirect that?
Yes, Denise, I and Alan, let me answer this right quick, if you will. I think it's important that we discuss this openly, as all the major reform leaders say. If we can just discuss it, if we can bring it out into the open and look at it, we can fix it. And okay, that so many people have hidden from fear or the discomfort and avoided the issue. And it's time to address it fully and to change it. Denise, gosh, I wish I had a longer time. We're going to have to cut it short here. I appreciate your call so much. Please call back next week. I hope to have two of those black ministers we're speaking of on the air here. We'll see how that goes along with Judge McSpadden. We're trying to work out the details.
Thank you so much for your program.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Alan, I like I said, I'm running out of time here. I got a couple other things I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But where can folks reach you, or what websites would you want to send them to where they can learn more about this situation?
Okay, well, I can be reached at 806-995-3353. And my email address, I'm kind of hesitant to put it over the air, but I will anyway, is Nanda Bean, that's Nanda Bean, at amaonline.com. I send out a lot of email stuff on the situation as well.
Wonderful stuff, folks, by the way. I tune into it. He's on top of the local situation. You have meetings with your you did have meetings with the community to try to resolve the overall look at this, didn't you?
With the white community, you mean? Or
well, I guess I remember you had you would meet at the cafeteria or something, and
yes, we were three representatives from our group, myself and Freddie Brookins and Thelma Johnson, were meeting with three representatives from they were all members of the local Methodist church here, people of goodwill. One was a retired surgeon and. Another was a retired pastor, and another one worked with senior citizens. And they're very good people. And we were able to make some progress, but there still was a gap. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that people have to live in this community. And this is such an emotional issue that if you are perceived as siding with the Friends of Justice, you will probably be essentially excommunicated. And it's in a small town, you know, there's nowhere to run and hide. You can't really have your privacy. People want to know where you stand on the issue. And especially during this election season, that has made it very difficult for candidates.
Yes, I would certainly agree. The few candidates I've talked to said, talk to me after the election.
That's right.
Yes. Well, Alan, thank you so much. We're going to have to bring you back again soon. There's just too much to talk about, and
yes,
I'm so sorry we've run out of time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I certainly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Alan. We're going to play a portion of your song, The Ballad of Jesse Ritter.
Crossed his fingers and he raised his hand. Told him Jesse Ritter was a businessman, like everybody knows. I remember very well the day the deal went down. On the 21st, or it was there around. I wrote it on my leg and then I run to town. That's all you gotta know. And there's 12 good people strung in two long rows. Remember little Jesse in his Sunday clothes. Remember how they said he could have made the pros. How is he put blind? And they spent a couple hours talking dates and times. Said Jesse Ritter down for 99. Sheriff seemed to think that Jesse's done the crime. He was never lying. So I'm certain he never been any about it. Like a ship in time, and away we died. Yeah, they were certain he never been any about these things. It's down to you. And it's a tiger. Well, the courtroom fell and the hammer fell, and they shipped Jesse Ritter down the road to hell. Slapped his body in a prison cell. It's shameful. I know. But Jesse Ritter's learning what it means to pray for God to come and strip the prison bars away. Somehow Jesse's gonna have his day. Don't ask me how I know. There's just a certain inevitability about it. Like the ship in time. Like the way we ride. Yes, there's a certain inevitability about these things when it's down to you, and it's so tight to you.
Okay, folks, that was the Ballad of Jesse Ritter, written and sung by Alan Bean. Last week, our last show, we actually got a pledge called in for our first rendition of the War of Terror Comedy Playhouse. Here's the second go. Well, soon here. Okay.
War of Terror Comedy Playhouse, a U.S. government-funded propaganda release. Tonight's show, the U.S. policy, sinking terror in the whole man.
Tonight's story begins in the Oval Office. The boy Wonder is alone, busy at his desk.
Just a minute. Yeah, hold on. Just one minute. Yeah, come on in.
Mr. President, Secretary Rumsfeld is here for his appointment. Mr. President, have you been hitting the sugar donuts again?
Oh, thanks, Betty. Gotta keep up on the appearances. Yeah.
Yes, Mr. President. Please be careful. Sugar can be, addicting.
That's what. I only do 2 spoonfuls a day. Good afternoon, 43. Hello, Rummy. How many sand creatures did we kill today?
The afternoon actions are scheduled to bring in a good body count. George, you've got some, powder?
Oh, dang, them donuts is messy. I want you to be sure and thank Coca-Cola for this, original formula. Fact is, I want you to send some to the pilots in the Gulf.
43, we've got some problems. The war games were a great success, of course, but only after the U.S. forces sort of lost 3 times.
But we did prevail. We did win, right?
Well, of course, but the U.S. ships had to be raised from the bottom of the ocean by a decree from my office.
You were able to successfully raise them, right?
Sure, I just had to say it was so. And then, when we told the enemy forces to look the other way, our attack on the beachhead was a complete success.
Whatever it takes. Of course that would work in this modern age. We won. Oh, yeah. We won. Handle it, Rummy. Handle it. Dad's counting on us. I fought the law and I won. I fought the law and I won.
We hope you enjoyed the War of Terror Playhouse. We'll have another one for next week. But for right now, here's Steve Nolan with the Activist Corner.
Thanks, Dean. We've got a couple of events coming up. If you'd like to help us in the war on drugs, coming up this Monday, at the courthouse, we're going to be having our monthly vigil. That's at 1201 San Jacinto. That's the criminal justice building downtown. It's going to be starting about 4:30. It's something that Houston Normal and the Drug Policy Forum of Texas have been doing for a while now on the last Monday of each month. And then coming out on the 1st of November, which would be a week from last night, Guy Schwartz is going to be having their tour baby event over at the Rhythm Room. That's 815 Washington. They're going to have a bunch of bands there. In case y'all didn't hear it on the during the fun drive. Guy Schwartz, he came out with a homegrown collective of pro-marijuana songs. So if you haven't checked that out, that's a good thing. Guy Schwartz, EP Vallejo, Dubtech Sound System, The Buddha Crush, Secret Agent 8, those are just some of the bands that are going to be playing. So y'all come out and check that out. That's going to be next Friday over at the Rhythm Room. And then next Saturday, Houston Normal is going to be marching for medical marijuana in the Art Car Parade. The parade's going to be starting at 4 p.m. at 140 Heights, which is the Art Car Museum. So if y'all want to check out some cool cars, and if you want to help us march for medical marijuana, come on out. But that's about it for Activist Corner. Back to you, Dean.
Thank you, Steve. I want y'all to please listen in next week at this time, next Friday night. Glenn Erbach and The Other Side will air. And please be sure to listen to Rourke's show every Monday through Friday in the afternoon for some great music and for a daily presentation of the 420 Drug War News. Please join us in 2 weeks. We are scheduling a sitting judge, an incumbent Texas attorney, a district attorney, and a couple of black ministers to come here to discuss how we will end this 88-year war on our own people. Now, I wanted to say something. A friend of mine passed today. Y'all don't know him. Hell, it was my dog. His name is Wiley. Best friend of man you ever met. And I just, my kids are missing him. I'm just saying he's probably off in a better field, probably in a great cannabis field, chasing down some glaucoma medicine. I want to thank Tammy once again for the great work she did when she talked to Noam Chomsky. You know, there's a lot that each one of us can do. There's a lot that each one of us should do. You know, the fact is, everyone I talk to, we cannot get a prohibitionist to call in here. We cannot get one to come on the air. The only place that they'll duel is perhaps on the editorial pages of the newspaper. But as far as sitting down one-on-one, comparing data, comparing hard fact and reality, you can't get them to do it because, as Alan and I spoke earlier, they're hiding behind a masquerade that gives them economic incentive to continue this war. It gives them, quote, the moral high ground from which they take pot shots at everybody that they consider to be inferior to them in some regard, whether it be skin color or economic status. But I guess the main point is that we have to stand up. We need to have you down at the courthouse. We need to have you come to the federal courthouse or any of the prisons where we protest. We need you to become part of this effort to make the change. Now, if you paid any attention, you're starting to see that the media is for reform. You're starting to see that the vast majority of people are for reform, but because of the fear handed down from on high for so long, because of that supposed moral high ground that they have supposedly ensconced themselves in, people have just been reluctant to say or do anything, even if it affected their family, even if it affected themselves. They somehow feel that it's right and justified and the Christian thing to do, and I want to assure you, it's not. Please, if you get the chance, contact the folks at the Drug Policy Forum of Texas. They're on the web at
www.dpft.org.
And if you want to join Houston Normal, call me, 713-922-4367. My cell phone will be on in about 1 minute. This show is just about over. I want to thank you for listening in. I want to thank Alan Bean for taking the time to be with us this evening, and I want to invite each and every one of you to become a part of the solution. Stand up to these drug warriors. They do not have a leg to stand on, and it's imperative that you do your part. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth.